another issue that you should think about, and I don't know the answer to this. I wish somebody would tell me. Suppose the corporations buy back the shares that are sold. That means you have a diminishing number of shareholders. You could have a situation, I think, where this corporation that you have here might buy back the shares for people who wanted to sell. Those people who sell still live here. They're still part of the community. But the number of shareholders is diminishing, exercising the right to buy back, assuming they got the money to do it. So you could wind up with a very small number of people controlling the shares that of the corporation that owns a lot of the land here, and the majority of native people in the community holding no shares and having no right to say what happens on that land. And that, it seems to me, could, I don't know whether it would be here, but I've been to communities, I've been to villages, where that could be a very unhealthy state of affairs. This act, you know, just has so many features to it that baffle you as you try to thread your way through it. And the buyback thing troubles me for that, for a number of reasons. But that's when what kind of a body of shareholders are you going to have in 50 years or 25 years? Yeah.
Yeah, it's Alvin Ostrobecki. Now, when you will your shares to somebody what was born after the Land Claim Settlement Act, are they allowed to vote your stock?
Well, they are when they're 18. If they're non-native, they're not allowed to.
No, if they're native, but they weren't in there during the, you know, they're too young to be, they were born after 1971.
Oh, well, they can't, they can't because they're too young to vote the stock.
No, when they get old enough, if you turn the stock over to them.
Oh, yeah, when they're old enough, they can.
So I thought something was brought up about that earlier. Only if you sell it to somebody that's not a native, then they couldn't vote.
Not until after 1991.
Oh, anybody can vote then. Yeah.
After 1991.
Anyway. Yeah, I guess that's what we talked about. Okay.
I'd like to inject something into that. Isn't there a possibility that the corporation can change their bylaws and still restrict the voting rights are non-native after 1991?
Yeah. Yes, there is.
Would that be a simpler way to do it? Would that have to be a two-thirds majority of the stockholders or what?
Right now, I think you can do it by 50% majority. But after 1991, I think you'll need two-thirds to do it. Remember this, though. Any vote like that, the shareholders can always vote to reverse it, if you follow me. The other thing is that if you have a regulation or bylaw that says non-native shareholders can't vote, but that group of non-native shareholders is still growing because they're growing now. They're growing every day because they're acquiring shares through divorce and by inheritance. The state, I'm told, is holding shares where a native, let's say a case where a native man and his wife have separated or divorced, and he's supposed to be paying maintenance or alimony or whatever you call it here, support, and he hasn't been. They can take his shares. They can't do anything with them, but the state is holding those until 1991, and I think there you've got a built-in group that says, hey, we're trying to protect these women. We want to sell these shares. You have a growing body of non-native shareholders that becomes more and more, I assume, will likely become more and more concerned that they have no say in what happens. That's why that provision that you speak of might not be the simple answer that it appears to be. And that's what I think you should avoid this time, is opting for something that looks like an easy way out, and then finding in 10 years you've just got to go through all this all over again.
I think in the meeting, the first meeting this afternoon, would help answer some questions. You asked Mr. Osterbeck, who was instrumental in starting this Aleut Corporation, he mentioned in Juneau way back when, what exactly did those people want, what was their intentions, and when the government made this grant exactly, what were the bottom line intentions? I'll get it right down to basics. What did the native want when he went to Uncle Sam and said, give us this? What, in fact, did, what was wanted?
Well, just what I said earlier, they were drilling a couple of oil wells up in Canoe Bay. Couple of different outfits, one on the northwest side of the bay and one on the southeast side of the bay. And we just happened to stop in Juneau and the wife. We went to the session down there. We used to stop in on our way to Seattle on vacation. And Judge O'Connor and Flory Lacanov come and said, Bristol Bay is trying to take part of your region. That's the first time we heard about the Native Land Claim Settlement Act. So Judge O'Connor, he's on the bench in Anchorage right now, one of the Supreme Court judges. And him and Flory Lacanov, they got a whole Anne Marie, and we drawed up articles that included Pribilof Islands and everybody. Just the groundwork, you know, nobody knew too much about it. But we felt, and we talked it over with Judge O'Connor, that we shouldn't let somebody else take our land, like the Aleutian Islands, the Pribilof Islands, and that. So the two, what we were looking at was Bristol Bay already had, trying to get their hand on Canoe Bay. And we said, what if we don't do anything? Kodiak might want to take the land in under their Native Land Claim Settlement Act. So far as I can remember, that's what we started over. And from there on, I said it wasn't much. We had no money. We had no office. We just tried to get something started. And I finally pulled out of it in a couple of years, and I think Johnny Gunderson went in as president of it, and I'm not sure, but I think Carl Moses got in after that. And that's when they started drawing up what was going to happen with the Shoemaking Corporation. It turned into a big thing after that. So that's about all I can tell you on it.
That isn't exactly what I was looking for. I was wondering, I thought that you were in the basics right from the beginning of the people who wanted something of the government, where in fact you heard that somebody else was making a grab and we wanted a piece of it. That isn't what I was looking for. I was looking for the original intent of the group who first asked for a land grant.
Well, we had Ann Reardon, who's a teacher at the University of Alaska at Anchorage, review all the testimony that Alaska Natives gave to congressional committees back in the late 60s when ANCSA was being developed, and to see what it was Native people said to those committees. What did they want out of a land claim settlement? And she wrote a paper that's part of the transcript of our proceedings, and in fact has been published, and in it Native people said they wanted to protect subsistence, they wanted to protect their land for future generations. They wanted the capital to develop the land to create employment. They wanted to preserve their culture and their heritage. I think those were the main things. That's what they wanted. The leaders who went to Washington and negotiated, quite a few of them have testified, and they have said that their purpose was to get as much land for the native people as they could. That is, they knew the thing was going to be settled. Their idea was that they had to get as much land as they could. And they thought it, they regarded it as a real estate transaction. That is, they were trying to make sure that they got as good a settlement as they could. Congress, now Senator Jackson, who was the principal architect of ANCSA, is dead now. His special assistant came to testify, the man who had helped him to write the legislation, and said that Senator Jackson and the other leaders in Congress regarded it as social engineering. They were going to change Native people, they were going to use this as a means of social engineering, that is, getting Native people to think like white businessmen and act like them and invest like them and save like them and become part of the mainstream of American life. Now, that seems to be fairly clearly what Congress wanted to do. I'm just going on telling you what I've heard in the evidence. Those are the three things, what the people in the villages wanted, what the leaders felt they were trying to do, and what Congress thought it was trying to do. Well, Congress is the outfit that passed the law, and the law reflects, I think, more clearly what they wanted than it reflects what the others wanted. Well, that's perfectly natural. They're the lawmakers, and this is a law. It's called a settlement, but it's really a law. It's not a negotiated treaty. It's not a contract. It's a law passed by Congress.
I should say that if the majority of the corporations, of the native corporations, enterprises, are not successful, and in 1991 this land were sold, that intent, that effort by the federal government would be completely defeated.
Yeah. Well, I suppose it might be. Then again, it might not be, because they thought that Native people would be shareholders. And all right, you've got your shares in 20 years. You've made your corporation successful. Your shares are worth a lot of money. You go out and sell your shares, buy shares in another corporation. You become an investor, a capitalist, and good luck to you. Well, that was the theory. Now, in putting this idea of together, they got the thing, in a sense, wrong end too. For instance, if somebody sees an economic opportunity out there, or somebody in this town sees an economic opportunity, he goes to the bank and tries to borrow the money, and then he goes to his lawyer and gets a corporation formed. And then he goes and he undertakes this business venture, whatever it is. Well, the way ANCSA works, they gave people a corporation and they gave them the money, said, okay, go and find something to do. Go and find an opportunity. And they didn't understand that there aren't that many opportunities. You could send Lee Iacocca out with some money and a corporate and a corporation to some village on the Arctic slope and say, okay, let's see you make some money, sell some cars. And I don't think he could do it. That's why I say this is a very special kind of setup you've got here. Yeah.
I probably missed something when I ran out, but I wanted to thank you for going over the alternatives, because I think there's a sense right now by a lot of the Native people that there isn't a choice, and 1991's going to come. And I think it's real important to stress that there are other alternatives, and that it's something that if people are unified, they can think of alternatives.
Well, I can tell you that in most villages where I go, there are some people who say, well, we can straighten out these corporations, and they can be the vehicles somehow to hold the land in the future. Others say, no, let's turn them over to our tribal governments, our IRA governments. And I've said at each stop, no, well, wait a minute, let's not get locked into one of these things. Let's look at all the possibilities. And I think that when you look at the other possibilities, it may be that that some of them will be suited to people here in the Aleutians, others better suited to people in the Arctic Slope, people on the Yukon River, wherever. But it would be a tragedy, it seems to me, if the Alaska Natives did lose their land and wound up like the Native Hawaiians, people without any land. And I think the trick is to hang on to that land in a way that,
that's the whole idea of the meeting, isn't it?
Well, it's turned out that way. When I started, you were all talking about selling your shares, and I thought, good, I found some people who want to sell their shares and get some dough and say goodbye to it all. I keep looking for those people. You keep talking, and you talk yourselves out of it. So,
I for one am conflicting in my views from when I first came in. Sell, get some money, but not at the risk of losing your land to somebody from Texas.
I think this was a good eye-opener to some of them, then. It changed their mind. I hope they don't change it again.
How did the people of Hawaii lose all their land? You mean they got it and then they just sold it off as they felt like it?
No, it's that really is another story. But they had a monarchy, and the monarchy held all the land. The king, the queen.
Oh, and he just sold it.
You'll forgive me for saying this, but there's a lot of evidence that the Americans took over the Hawaiian throne, and that enabled them to get the land along with it. But it has meant that there's a land claims movement there, and by about 120,000 people who really have virtually no land that has come to them as their inheritance as the original peoples. Everybody else in Hawaii has done well. But the original landowners have virtually nothing. Well, nobody wants to see that happen here.
Wasn't there a group of people in Hawaii referred to as the Golden Race? Have you heard that expression?
No.
Like 20 or 30 years ago, we thought that Hawaii had the ideal land situation where they owned it, where in fact the monarch or the king owned it. I always thought the people owned Hawaii, you know, and they were the best example of natives in the United States.
Well, they don't feel that way. They're coming to Anchorage to testify before our commission, and they're eager to tell us about the fact that they are native people without land.
They were in Anchorage here a few years ago. I can't recall just when, but they had a meeting there, and I think they were at the convention, and then they had a meeting at Captain Cook's Hotel. And I can recall they were saying the missionaries got most of their land. They were trying to borrow money from the Aleut Corporation so they could start up a land claim, something like we're doing here, you know.
Well, there is a presidential commission that just reported a year ago on their land claims. It was appointed by President Reagan. It consisted of 6 people from Washington, D.C., who were actually officials of the government, and 3 Native Hawaiians, and they decided in their report against the Hawaiians, 6-3. And they said that not only do the Hawaiians have no legal claim, but they have no moral claim either. And this was a great disappointment to Native Hawaiians, but it means the land claims movement hasn't died. It's still going on. Tammy?
This is just a question that you might be able to answer. It's more out of ignorance than actually giving input. But what will the status of the nonprofit, Native nonprofit organizations be after 1991? Is there any speculation?
I don't think it would change. I don't think, the nonprofits really exist independently of ANCSA. You don't have shares. You're not liable to be taxed because you're not making a profit. You don't own land unless you own a building or rent an office somewhere. You really deliver services that are contracted with the federal government for the most part, I think. So I don't think that unless the federal government adopted a policy of termination, that is, terminating the special relationship between Alaska Natives and the federal government, then there would be no reason to have the nonprofits and no reason for them to contract with the federal authorities. But short of that, I don't think you're affected in any way, and I can't imagine the federal government terminating its relationship with Alaska Natives because it isn't likely to terminate its special relationship with Natives in the Lower 48, so I can't imagine they would do it in Alaska. It's been talked about, but I just can't imagine the government of the United States doing that. So I don't think the nonprofits are greatly affected. I haven't thought about it very hard, but I can't see how. I mean, you then have people probably coming to you. With requests for services, and they happen to be people who are no longer shareholders in Native corporations or don't hold land. I mean, that's the change. Oh, Mary?
Yeah, there's about, I think I heard a number around 450 shareholders in the Shoemaking Corporation. And to show you how interested they are in this, in the corporation, there's 5 stockholders up here at the meeting. So, Andrew said it probably opened the eyes on some of us, but there's only 5 of us here. And like what I'm saying, if there's nothing done by 91, the corporation stockholders could sell their share and there would be nothing stopping them. And if they sell their share with the land, which it would put it into the hands of somebody else, if you can find somebody to buy it, you know, in different places, they're going to be able to sell all kinds of land where they're closer to Anchorage and different cities. But right out here, if the fishing go down any more than it is, the land out here isn't going to be worth anything, as far as I can see. So, I don't know what's going to happen, but Sandpoint been one of the richest communities in the United States here a few years ago. It was in the state house when I was down there that they were the richest community in the state of Alaska. And in, according to a lot of other places in the lower 48 for population-wise. Mm-hmm. And right now it's dropping down, you know, where the guys are looking, how are we going to make our boat payments? Because the fishing went down. When the fishing was good, nobody was interested in the land claim. And right now it don't seem like there's too many people interested in it. Because they fish 12 months out of the year. They were into salmon, then king crab and tanner crab, and by that time it was time to go back into salmon again. And nobody was worried about the Land Claim Settlement Act. They had everything they wanted. Nobody would go to the meetings. Nobody would wanted to join. They run for a seat. We have a couple guys at a Sandpoint now. It's in the Aleut Corporation and the Shoemaking Corporation. It's got seats in, but there isn't too many people interested right now. I mean, I don't have to say that. You can tell that by looking around the room in here. And this was advertised on the radio here, the local radio station, so everybody knew what was coming up today. And what I'm trying to put across, maybe we understand it, a few of us was here, but if nobody do anything about it, when 91 come rolling around, the guys can sell, and I know a lot of people that said they sell their shares to the highest bidder. So that's the point I wanted to bring across. Thank you.
The well, it's you know, I've had about 30 or 31 or 32 of these meetings, and some of them have been very well attended. You know, everybody's turned out. Others, average attendance, I suppose, and a few not very well attended at all. But you get something different out of each one, I suppose. I've just had a week of meetings in another region that were very well attended. People really spoke about their desire not to give up the land, but the nature of the meeting was such, and the room was full, that that's really about all people felt free to say. Here, we've had the advantage of being able to kick ideas around all day, and I found it quite useful. People have had experience with your local village corporation, with the regional corporation, and it's given us an opportunity to throw these ideas around. Knew about the meeting and weren't sufficiently interested to turn up, that itself may be something significant that that may be may be considered. Although I don't usually attach very much significance to it, because there may be a multitude of reasons why people don't come to meetings. They may be sick of meetings, or they may have had to go out fishing or something. I don't know. I think the halibut season opens in 12 o'clock tomorrow, doesn't it? And we were at one village, Angoon, where we came just as they were getting ready to go out halibutting. And the attendance wasn't very good. The ones who came seemed very interested, just as you people seem very interested.
Good is something if you can't sell it, you know. I can see, like you said, all these areas are different. You know, this is a big state. Some people that have to live off the land, I can see where they wouldn't want to sell it, but down here, not too many people live off the land.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, what, if you've got something and you can't sell it, it's like having a big diamond in your hand. You can look at it. What good is it? If I had to go out here and get a caribou or something all the time and I needed to go out here, you know, maybe 20 years from now you'll have to, but right now you don't.
Well, then to your point is...
Yeah, you know, like say I own so much land. Well, maybe I'm sick of this place. I want to move to Australia or something. But I can't sell my land because you passed a law. You can't sell it. So it didn't do me any good.
That's right. If you had shares in General Motors, those are property. You can sell them anytime you want. You have shares in a native corporation, they're your property, but you can't sell them. And
no good, really, unless you stay here and utilize it yourself.
Well, they're a different form of property from shares in other corporations. But Congress, you see, thought after 20 years those shares will become just like any other shares. That was their whole point.
I think, Jerry, you and I have two different situations. I said the same thing in different words, whereas if I sold and I stayed here and my grandchildren stayed here, they'd be living on somebody else's property. In your instance, you talked about moving to Australia. You wouldn't give a damn who owned the property, would you?
No.
Yeah. Two different situations. Then how would you feel? Would you feel the same way if, in fact, you could own the land, sell your buildings, take that money, and live here, and still own the land?
Here's how I think it was. Here's how I'd do it. There's so many people in this corporation, and there's so many acres. I'd divide it all up equally. If they wanted to sell it, let them. If you wanted to keep yours, you could keep yours. If you wanted to keep yours for your family down the line, do it. If I didn't, I'd sell it.
You're saying liquidate the assets, wind up the corporation, divide up the assets.
No, just they can keep their corporations, but say this corporation in this town, they could say, take the land, divide it all up between the stockholders here and let them have their land, whatever it comes to. 200-300 acres apiece, and let them do what they want with it. Sell it or keep it or anything.
I don't think we got enough money in the bank to survey it.
If you own it, you can really sell a piece of it yourself. You can just mark a line out on it. Mm-hmm. You can't? You mean I sold a piece of land and I couldn't do it?
You have to have a survey.
Forget what that survey fee cost up there. $160,000, $220,000? Just to survey that subdivision, you know.
That's how much it costs? Well, we're going to have to send one of our own people to school and do it free, then.
There you go, point.
That could be done.
Mm-hmm.
Something different which was said to me as I walked around town that I haven't heard anywhere else is, well, this whole land claims thing was kind of irrelevant and nobody owed us anything anyway, so I don't know why it all happened. And nowhere else have I heard that, and I heard that a couple times here. You know, it's not of interest to me because we were never owed anything, and this was just sort of something that came out of the blue, and so what?
Windfall.
Mm-hmm. Would anybody care to comment on that?
I've heard comments like that. A lot of people were talking about the land claims deal, and somebody said, well, quite a few people actually said, well, I never had it, you know, and if somebody gives me $100 for it, so what, you know, I'll take it. You know, I didn't have to pay for it. So, I don't know.
See, in most places that we've been, people really feel that something had been taken from them for which they deserve to be compensated. And the people that I spoke to here didn't feel that way.
Well, it's like they never had it anyway. Most people around here feel like they still don't have anything. They'll go, oh, what are you talking about? They gave me land. I don't even have a lot. I'm living in an apartment. See what I'm saying? They never got any money. They got a few $100, but they're still living in an apartment. And they're saying, well, what are you talking about? What land? I never got a nothing. It's in the corporation, you know, and then they're trying to develop it and sell it, you know, and that might be the right way to do it. But like Alvin was saying, the fishing goes bad, probably everybody's going to move away anyway. It's worthless.
I went to Anchorage, the land office, and asked about getting a piece of land up on the hill to build a warehouse on. And they said, it's tied up in this grant, you know. I'm going to go along with you. Before the grant, you could go out there and build a shack, couldn't you, or a warehouse. Whereas now, it's not available. You own it, but it's not available unless you buy it.
What's like owning the moon or something, you know? What good is it? Unless you can use it.
And one of the other things that was different is that people made it really clear that their subsistence was pretty different. I mean, people, as you mentioned, don't go out and hunt caribou a lot, or it isn't a large part of their lives. One person said to me that the only time they considered using the subsistence privilege was to catch enough sea otters to make his wife a coat. And most of the people that I talk with got their meat from either Sears or shipped from Seattle, and not from around here. And that's pretty different than what we've heard in other places. I was talking about some of the things that people had told me as I knocked on doors and talked to people in the street. And, you know, one big difference was in people's attitude about the act. People saying, well, nobody owed us anything anyway. This was just kind of something that came out of the blue, a windfall. And the second thing was that people did not seem to have the same kind of dependence on what's been called subsistence activity that people do in other places. I mean, when I came to your house, you people told me how you bought your meat from Sears, you know, rather than going out and shooting a caribou or something. You know, it's different than we found in other places.
You can't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
But you're fishing. And it's cheaper to buy it. First time I bought meat from Sears was my wife was out in Anchorage and bought it at 98 cents a pound. It was real good meat, cut and wrapped. And instead of taking a couple days off from fishing, you can make more in a couple days fishing than you could do hunting. Because a lot of times you can go out and don't get anything. Even I got cattle down on West Nisinski, it don't pay to go down and kill them unless it's in the winter time. With all the fuel costs, and you'd have special insurance if your boat isn't insured year-round. And when you go down there, it's going to cost you $400 or $500. You can get meat cut and wrapped from Anchorage for a family my size for $500-$600 for almost a whole year.
You can compare that to your life in Anchorage if you live there, whoever lives there. You can't drive a car to the beach in Kenai or Kasilif and dig a bucket of clams or hunt a moose or catch a fish down there cheaper than you could go to Safeway and buy this. You get better clams in Safeway too.
You know, like you were talking earlier, you were saying earlier that no matter what the people decide here, years down the line, they can have a vote and change it, right?
Yeah. Well, the corporation could by a vote of its shareholders adopt a certain bylaw and then rescind it later on. I mean, that's...
You know, like in Sandpoint here, we could say, well, we're going to go over to Zachary Bay here and here will be a big reservation here that anybody can move over on and it's for the natives. Okay, well, 20, 30 years down the line or 50 years, those people could say, well, we don't want this place, let's sell it. You know, everything's going to change. It doesn't matter what we decide. I mean, 20 years from now, there'll be a bunch of different people sitting here, and then they'll do what they want. sure, we can decide something and say, yeah, we should hang on the land. I think it's a good idea too, so we won't be like these people in Hawaii. You know, some guy will have to buy a piece of land. But if you even have a reservation or you set half of the land aside, you can never sell it. Well, you can always change it. Just like you said, two-thirds of the people in the corporation are half. They can decide what to do with it. So it's not really probably up to us. It's those people will make their own decisions later on.
Well, it's up to you for now.
Right, for now.
And if you can persuade, you know, the next generation and have an influence on them, it's up to you to that extent. And isn't it probably a good thing that things aren't locked in? I don't know. I mean, I'm expressing my own personal opinion now, but it seems people change too. And what is right now for people may not be in years to come.
Depending on the choices you make now or in the next few years, upon that will depend whether in 25 years the next generation has anything to choose about. If they may have no choices. You say they might decide to sell it. Well, sure, they might. But if they don't have it, there's no choice in the matter.
Well, if they decide to sell it, then the next ones won't have anything to sell.
That's right.
Either you keep it and never sell it, or else you sell it. What's the difference if we sell it, or the next generation, or the next, or the next, or the next?
Well, but you make every decision in light of what you think is best for your generation and coming generations, and the question is, what do people, shareholders in these corporations, think is the best thing to do now? And I mean, you can argue about the futility of making any decision if you want to, any decision in life. In a billion years, the universe will be extinguished. There won't be anybody here or even the memory of any of us. So why are we even sitting around here tonight?
It's so good to be here, though.
I think it would help to speculate on what would happen if nothing were done, and in 1981, 51 or 2% of the shareholders sold their share to one group, and they then would have control of this area. What impact would it have on the people living here?
Just depends on who bought it.
And what they did with it.
Yeah. If I bought it, I wouldn't let you hunt on it anymore.
Well, there you go. That is the fact. Hey, if I paid you, would you let me?
Yeah.
Sure. That's the way it should be right now.
What, you think? I was talking to some people, and I said, well, geez, maybe we should have a, you know, like a big reservation here, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 acres or something that was you could never sell, and people could live on it for a long time. They said, it'd turn into one of them crummy Indian reservations. See, like down below. That's what they told me.
Well, they should go to
Who told you that?
Awesome people. That's real nice, huh?
Maybe you
can
say something
about Metcalfe. Well, but that's... look, Alaska has always rejected the idea of Indian reservations. The government rejected that, and Native people appear to have rejected the idea of Indian reservations. There is only one Indian reservation in Alaska, and that's Metlakatla. And it happens to be one of the most prosperous and thriving Native communities in the state. Whether that's because it's a reservation or not, I don't know. I went down and held a hearing there. They are the people who refuse to come into the settlement. They have an island, it's a reservation, called Annette Island, and they said in 1971 to Congress, no, we'll just keep our island. And that meant they had to surrender any right to receive money. They didn't get a nickel. And they said, no, we'll just stay here on our island. And they have a tribal government. And they're the only place I've been to where people aren't worried about 1991 because they have nothing to worry about.
Can I go down there and buy a piece of land at Metlakatla?
Not unless they were willing to sell it to you.
But they can sell it to whoever they want.
Well, except that they're not selling it.
I see.
You've got one more up in Savunga?
I've never joined a native corporation. I don't know if it's Savunga. It's up on St. Lawrence Island up there somewhere.
The former reserves, Elan and Savunga?
Yeah.
I believe they never joined it.
I think that they did.
No.
They were former reservations. We still have to visit those communities, so I can't speak knowledgeably about them.
Well, so far as I know some people who went up there who held meetings, and they said they're the only ones up here that never joined the native corporations.
Well, I can tell you the people at Metlakatla feel that they made the right decision. But, of course, there weren't that many places that had reservations in 1971. In other words, it wasn't a choice of saying, we'll keep our reservation. You didn't have reservations here except at Metlakatla and some of these other places. So it was only a limited number of communities that really had any choice in the matter, that could say, we'll keep our land. Most communities didn't have any land that was acknowledged to be their land. So. But I think that the question of how native lands are held and how they're managed is a broader question than just reservations or no reservations, corporations or no corporations. Those are the two choices Congress felt they had to make back in 1971, and they said, we don't want any reservations up there in Alaska, so we'll give you corporations instead. Well, 13 years later, the mind of man has devised ideas that go beyond those two conceptions, and perhaps something else can be worked out.
But the thing else that I heard as I wandered through town was that this is definitely a man's town, and I don't know, looking at the people who are here, I'm not sure whether or not that's true or whether it might not be true, but I don't know if anyone wants to comment on that. I said it probably doesn't.
I would like to present an hypothesis, you might say, the worst thing that could happen to the land. Let's go back and say that 51% of it was sold to a private organization or an oil company, a very selfish company, and you would like to go over to Left Hand Bay and stand on the bank and catch a salmon. I would like to step ashore in Kegeon, or you would like to go to Canoe Bay and hunt a caribou, and they say no. Could that happen?
Sure, if it's their land.
It could happen right now.
Yeah.
With your own people.
Your own corporation.
Unlikely. It's more apt to happen with a private company from Pennsylvania or someplace, wouldn't it? If they were able to buy 51% of the Shumigin Corporation, then they would say, you keep off that land. Under no conditions are you allowed to step on that land. That's what could happen.
Yeah, it could. The Shumigin Corporation right now can tell certain people that they can't do that. So it doesn't have to be an oil company.
Yeah, I was talking about the members, the shareholders. They could tell everybody not to step on it. If I didn't sell mine and 51% of the shareholders sold, the board and the president could do anything they'd like, wouldn't they? Even say shareholders cannot step on there anymore. Of course, they could be replaced. But the majority of shareholders would rule. They own 51% of the share. They'll elect their own board. They'll make the rules. And the 49% natives stand there with their mouth open, wondering what happened. I guess this is the worst thing that could happen, and this is what this meeting is all about, what we're going to do to prevent
that from
bad happening. Things from happening.
Right. It never happened. The Shoemaking Corporation don't have enough money to put the guards out to keep the guys off their land. And the oil companies would be too busy, they wouldn't bother about it. They want friends up here because they're going to drill all over for oil.
They aren't as friendly as oil people. You go over to the mine over there, if they don't like the looks of you, they'll tell you to bug off. In fact, they have chased people off their property.
You had your hand up, huh?
Trying to think. Well, the main theme of this is trying to, how are you going to hold on to the land after 1991 and the transfer of stocks? This got nothing to do with all these other little things we're discussing.
Right.
Sorry, what other little things?
Well, they were talking about chasing guys off the land.
Oh, well, no, but Mr. McMullen is really just putting forward a worst-case scenario, McCallum, I mean, and that's just thinking through the implications of what happens, which is...
What happens, I'll say, up on the Aleut region, North Slope, southeastern Alaska, some of those decide down there they're going to restrict their stock and they're going to head on to their land, and somebody else has a different version, and the Aleut Corporation, I mean, the Aleut region has a different version of it. How are they going to resolve it? Each one can do whatever they want, each region?
Well, right now, each region, each village can bring in a buyback provision. This village could adopt a buyback provision. The village that Mr. Gunderson represents, a little village, I've forgotten the name of it, they might not. Well, everyone might have its own particular variation. When I talked about options, I was talking about all of these options from corporations to IRA governments to other kinds of trust arrangements and so on that that have come up at the meetings we've had. But right now you've got a range of options if you want to adopt them.
So where does the AFN fit on that? They seem to be doing their own thing.
Well, they're quite naturally looking at how to deal with 1991. And I think they have a series of six proposals that they've circulated around the state, and I can well imagine that they're concerned about 1991 and want to develop a series of carefully thought out proposals.
But do they get the input from each village then, all the way out the chain and all around the area?
Well, I don't know. I'm not a member of the AFN.
Yeah, well, I just wondered how they did that. They were just their own thinking, or do they get out to the villages and try and get a feeling of how they feel about it?
Well, they've had retreats to which they've invited people from around the state.
They don't get all the people that way.
Well, let me put it this way. I think this commission is the only outfit that's going around to the villages. But the AFN is well aware of what we're doing and subscribed to the transcripts, and I'm sure will read my recommendations.
Well, this is the first concrete thing I've seen of somebody really coming in here and talking to people about it. And I think when you leave here, I think whoever came to this meeting here will understand it much better. And does what you hear here, this will be fed into the AFN too?
Well, this transcript that is made,
yeah.
they they get a copy. But, I mean, nobody can sit down and read it day after day. We have it so that it's available for reference. We have it so that I can go back to it in working on my report and say to myself, I remember those people in the Aleutian chain had a lot of interesting things to say. I just want to check back on it. But the main thing is that when I write my report, it'll be based, as far as it is possible, on what you've told me. So I want there to be a body of evidence that supports what I have to recommend.
Where will your... I asked you this earlier, but I don't remember. Where will your report go?
Well, I've been asked to do this. I've been appointed to do it by the Inuit Circumpolar Conference and the World Council of Indigenous People. My report goes to them, but they've agreed it'll be made public. So will be made public here next summer. Those two organizations are formally associated with the United Nations, and they will submit it to the United Nations, but it'll be available for people here to use it to go to Congress if they want to and say, look, this guy spent a year going around Alaska listening to what people had to say. Here's what he recommended, and we think this is the way we should go. So if I can do that much, I'll be very pleased. This will have been time well spent.
Andrew was talking about there with AFN. I don't know too much about it, but Alvin Duane called me after he made his first trip up to Dellingham, and he said the AFN and all the leaders were up there, all the presidents like Roger Lang and you name all of them, you know, from the corporations was up on the AFN meeting, and they were talking about the land and the fisheries and everything in concern. But he was with a different group. He was with Exxon.
When I was in False Pass a couple weeks ago, AFN was over there doing a similar thing, trying to get input in education. And I don't know where all they're going, but they have sent some representatives with their limited budget out to the villages to try and get some input and do some education. I don't know how extensive that's been.
Well, I guess it's not an easy task because the area is large, expenses way up there. So.
Well, and you will have seen that...
There are limited resources to do things, so I could see that, I guess.
And you will have noticed yourselves that we've spent all day discussing this. I mean, you can't wrap your mind around it in 5 minutes. You've got to sit down and think about it. And that's why in the villages I don't usually engage in a discussion of this detail. That's why this has been useful. I'm really there most of the time to find out what is important to people. What do they want to do? How do they feel about the sale of shares? And
you said the AFN was in False Pass. Did he say if they're coming any other places?
No, I got their card, though, and their contact number. That was a couple of months ago, and they were meeting with the village council there. And I think a lot of it was education on what the issue's all about.
Yeah. I was just wondering where all are they traveling to? Nobody seemed to know.
No, I just happened to cross paths.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is there any testimony being taken from the corporation, the shareholders who are in the corporation outside of Alaska?
Well, we intend to hold a meeting in Seattle for them. It'll be in the new year sometime. Maybe hold it a couple of evenings in Seattle. That's the best we can do. The shareholders of the 13th region have asked us to hold a meeting there. And there's a lot of Sea Alaska shareholders there who have asked us to hold a meeting. So We intend to do that, but right at the moment, it's more important, I think, to get around Alaska and see what people here want to do.
You've been to a lot of villages now. What's the best one that the best one they come up with yet for keeping their lands? What did they decide?
Well, I'm still weighing it. You know, these aren't easy to decide on. I want to wait for Professor Johnson and David Case to come up with their recommendations for me, and I want to see what the AFN has got. Three lawyers, good lawyers, working out some questions for them. I want to see what they come up with and then weigh it all up. That's, and of course, match it against what people have said in the villages and see what then appears to be the best solution.
Well, you get to Seattle, and he's as president of the 13 region down there.
Oh.
Julie. So you'll probably meet her down there.
And her last name is...
I don't know what it'll be. She's getting married. Her name was Evans, but she's getting married again now, so...
I could swear I met a man in Anchorage about 6 months ago with a Norwegian name who claimed he was the president of the 13th region. Am I losing my mind?
No, he is mistaken. He has an Aleut group down there that she is president. It's called the North Pacific Aleut Council. And she is president of that group up there.
Who, Aleut?
Yeah.
Whatever.
The outside Aleuts that living in the Seattle area.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, I'm a member of that thing too, so I know.
Well, I hope she...
she's on something down there, but she's with that group in Seattle, Aleuts.
Well, that's good to know. She's the sort of person we should make sure is notified.
I know people in the 13th Corporation. They wish they were in the Aleut Corporation right now.
she's in the 13th Corporation, and I don't know, her sister was just telling me something. I don't know if she knew too much about it, but she said she was, her mother Lily was up here. She was telling me about it. So she's president of the whole thing, or just what you said there.
It's just Pacific Northwest Aleut Council is an organization of Aleuts living in the Seattle area.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Well, look, thanks very much for coming over. We've heard from 10 people here today, which is a respectable showing. It's been a good discussion, and I'm glad you all came. We go on to Unalaska tomorrow to see what they've got to say, and the following day to Acutan, and the day after that to St. Paul. And
Atka, I've never seen that on your list. You're not going off there? It's too far.
Cost a fortune.
And a half.
It would be nice to be able to go everywhere, but you can't.
Right, there's too many places.
We have been in contact with people in Atka, and one of their residents, who's a board member of the Aleut Corporation, Alice Petrovelli, has agreed to collect testimony from them and to bring it to us in Anchorage when she comes for the next board meeting, which I believe is in October. So, end of September? Okay. Well, she said that she would be there the 20th and stay, yes, and then stay for the next 2 weeks.
Well, excuse me, when is the Aleut Regional Corporation Board meeting?
20th.
The 20th of this month?
That's Thursday.
That's just a board meeting, but their annual meeting is on the 17th of November. Their annual meeting.
And they will hold it in Anchorage?
Yeah.
That'll be in Anchorage?
Yeah.
You know, if we miss any of those people at the Pribilofs, we might be able to have them come to the office and give testimony like this, set aside some time for it when they're in for their annual meeting.
When was that other meeting? The public meeting?
November. It seemed like to me it's the 17th. That's close enough anyway. It's around the middle of September. I mean November.
At the board meeting, nobody voted. That's private.
Not unless you're invited.
I'm going out on the 20th.
Give you 3 minutes to speak.
Don't be here in time. We got the afternoon.
Is that worth a plane ticket? 3 minutes?
Well,
thank you for coming to this beautiful city.
It is a beautiful place.
And I think we gain a lot of information that'll be useful for us. And I'll assure you, if you come back here in 2002, I'll still be hanging on to my piece of land.
Okay. Nice to see you.
Thanks for coming. Yeah, glad I met you.
Okay, good luck. Pardon?
It's awesome traveling again tomorrow.
Yeah.
Well, enjoy.